Is solitary confinement a form of cruel and unusual punishment? Good Tuesday morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a nice holiday weekend out there. Just ahead, a new lawsuit against the Florida Department of Corrections says solitary confinement in the Sunshine State needs to end. Already getting your calls about this, you can join us. Give us a call right now, 549-2937. Then later, it's our Movable Feast with Lee Court, plus Tracing the Roots of Southern Rock right here in Jacksonville. A new PBS miniseries will do just that. All of that ahead this hour. But first this morning, a lawsuit has been filed challenging the use of solitary confinement in Florida prisons. The lawsuit claims that solitary is cruel and unusual punishment and even a form of torture. The Southern Poverty Law Center and other groups have filed a federal class action lawsuit against the Florida Department of Corrections, challenging the use of solitary. Here with more, we welcome by phone Shalini Goel Agarwal. She's supervising attorney with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Good morning. Good morning. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
And Lorette Phillipson, a former inmate who was locked up in solitary for 28 days. Lorette, thanks for joining the show as well.
Thank you.
And already getting your calls about the use of solitary confinement in Florida correctional institutions. What do you think about this new lawsuit? Give us a call at 549-2937. It's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org and tweets to at Melissa Injax. Shalini, let's start with you. This new lawsuit filed just this week, citing scientific, medical, and mental health evidence, trying to force the Florida Department of Corrections to end the use of solitary confinement. You'd been working up to this for some time. Tell us more about the arguments laid out in this lawsuit. Why should solitary end in Florida prisons?
Well, thanks. There are two main claims that we have in the lawsuit. The first is that, as you mentioned, solitary confinement is cruel and unusual punishment, so it violates the Eighth Amendment to the federal Constitution. And we say that because the impact of solitary confinement on individuals, there's a substantial risk of mental health damage, apart from physiological effects that people suffer. And you don't necessarily know that going into it. That, you know, you can imagine that if someone already is suffering from mental illness, subjecting them to solitary confinement where they don't have contact with people for 22 or more hours a day makes it a lot worse. But then even folks who don't have mental illness going into the experience of solitary confinement, a lot of them also have severe psychological impacts, you know, and it really increases the rates of suicidality and a lot of other psychological effects, like, you know, a lot of anxiety, symptoms of PTSD. There's a lot of damage that we're doing, and the Department of Corrections knows this. So that's the first claim. And the second claim is about disabilities, that what happens to people in solitary confinement when they have a disability, a physical or mental disability, that there's no ability, there's no process for them to have a reasonable accommodation for their disability. So, for example, we have one of our named plaintiffs is a man in a wheelchair who can't even move his wheelchair around in his cell because his solitary confinement cell is so small that his wheelchair physically will not, is not functional in that space.
It's 549-2937 to join us. One of the parties to your lawsuit is a Black transgender woman who's been held in solitary for 10 years. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, she's been in solitary for 10 years, and she has suffered starting from when she was 18 years old. And that's something else we've noticed, a trend from for a lot of the plaintiffs that we've encountered, that they've been put into solitary at a very young age, often because of, you know, kind of youthful misbehavior, things associated with youth, you know, lack of impulse control, things that, you know, just are a function of being young. And so our Black transgender plaintiff suffered from severe mental health symptoms for an extended period. She's been hospitalized for psychiatric reasons about 20 times. She's been placed in a suicide watch cell more than 50 times. And after each of these incidents, the Department of Corrections has returned her directly into isolation. So, you know, during this time in isolation for the last
10 years. So long for this particular person?
I think that under the Department of Corrections classifications, they put people in a form of extended solitary confinement that they called close management when they feel that they are a danger to themselves or to others. But I think what our lawsuit shows and what our investigation has shown is that, you know, that kind of appellation is being that or that kind of designation is being used far too widely.
And in fact, your numbers show that nationally about 4.5% of the prison population is in solitary, but in Florida it's more than double that. About
10%.
So aggressive use of solitary in Florida as compared to other states, is that right?
Certainly, yes.
Okay, and Laura Phillipson, you were locked up in solitary for 28 days. Why were you behind bars and why were you put in solitary?
I was placed in solitary while I was on work release. I had received a DR and I was sent back to...
And what's a DR? What's a DR?
Oh, I'm sorry. A disciplinary report.
Okay.
For an action they felt was wrong. And then I spent 28 days in confinement.
And what was that like?
It was very, very hard. First of all, you're in a small cell by yourself. You have no outside communication. You can't talk to your family. You can't see your family. You will have to rely on regular mail for things to go back and forth, which we know takes days. And sometimes, for whatever reason, they don't go out, they don't come in. You don't know if it's day or it's night. You don't have a clock. You don't have a watch. You don't have a radio. You have nothing. You're allowed paper, envelopes, stamps, a security pen. You can't use a regular pen, a Bible. And once a week, somebody will come by from the library and just hand you a book. And that's it. That's how you spend your time.
And as medical and mental health professionals argue that this is a form of cruel and unusual punishment, a form of mental torture, do you agree with that? Did you feel tortured by this experience?
Most definitely. After, you know, a few days, your mind starts to wander. And, you know, then thoughts start entering your head. And, you know, it was probably about 2 weeks where I really had to go deep inside myself to stop thinking of ways to end my life, because it's just a really, it is the worst experience I've ever had.
You became suicidal?
Yes, ma'am. Did I vocalize that to them? No, ma'am, I did not.
And Shalini, that's I think the most powerful argument your organization is making in federal court, that this causes inmates to become suicidal. Can you explain what goes on in someone's brain when they're placed in an extended period of solitary confinement that leads them to have suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts?
It's just that people are not meant to be kept in that kind of isolation. So even, you know, short exposure will greatly increase the risk of suicidality. In Florida, about 57% of the total number of folks in prison who committed suicide, that happened while they were in solitary confinement. And 88% of the suicides were by people who had at some point been in solitary confinement. So the effects are also not just limited to that period while the person is in isolation. It extends beyond that.
And why is Florida an outlier in the use of this form of correction within prisons?
That's a great question. I think that the Department of Corrections should try to figure that out. You know, they have their own director of mental health services has written papers for the Department of Corrections that characterize solitary confinement as a really important issue in criminal justice reform. And they note that folks with mental illness are 5 times more likely to be placed in isolation in the Florida Department of Corrections than folks without mental illness. So I think that they know that it's a problem. It is, I think, on them to explain why it is that they think it's, you know, it's a tool that they use so often.
And let's go to some calls now as we talk about the new lawsuit filed federally in Florida to end the practice of solitary confinement. It's 549-2937 to give us a call here on the show this morning. Cameron is in St. Augustine. Hey, Cameron, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Great show, guys, as always.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, you're talking about something that we use in a theater of war. We're talking about this is definitely torture. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It is 100% torture. It's cruel and unusual punishment. And, you know, the Florida Department of Corrections needs to understand that and get rid of it. And it should have happened a long time ago, in my opinion.
All right.
Yeah,
thanks.
That's all I want to say.
Thank you for that. Let me ask you, Shalini, as a response, a spokesperson for the Florida DOC Department of Corrections defended this practice, saying a person is placed in close management when through their behavior they demonstrate an inability to live in the general population, and that there are processes in place to evaluate these inmates and transition them back into the general population, that they only undertake what they call close management when it's absolutely necessary for safety and security. What about that defense?
I mean, I think the numbers should speak for themselves. There's 10,000 people that are being put in some type of isolation, and that includes folks in close management and other types of confinement. What Lorette was talking about, disciplinary confinement, administrative confinement, so different types of confinement, but confinement nonetheless. I doubt that the folks in Florida are just that much worse than folks in other states that they need to put in solitary for that long. I think that there's a problem with how we're implementing the tool. The other thing I wanted to mention about this is, you know, I saw in some statements that the Department of Corrections has said, well, you know, not everyone is just totally by themselves. Some people have a cellmate. And it's true that for some folks in isolation, there are what's called double-celled, where two people are in confinement. But the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, has made clear that that kind of isolation, whether it's alone or with a cellmate, where you're there by yourselves for 22 hours or more a day without normal human interaction, has the same kind of effect on a person's psyche and is as destructive. So just to make clear, we're defining isolation or solitary confinement to include both single-celled and double-celled isolation of people.
And Lorette Phillipson, what was the cell you were held in like? How big was it? What was the space like?
Okay, the length of the cell, it had two metal beds in it, so they ran one right after the other, so that would have been the length of the cell. And then it was, let's see, maybe 5 foot wide, and it encompassed the toilet and the sink as well.
So very small and confined space. And what's your answer to the Department of Corrections defense of this, that it's only needed to ensure the safety of the inmates that are being held this way and the safety of the other inmates?
I don't see how a prisoner who has broken a rule is declared a security or safety risk when the charges are minimal. So I don't agree with that statement. No.
Okay, let's go to a few more calls about this, beginning with Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Interesting topic, and I understand there's options to a rule, like the individual that was in a wheelchair that maybe for their own, quote-unquote, safety, they have to put them someplace where they feel they can protect that individual. So I can understand certain exceptions like that. But I'm just kind of curious, generally speaking, I would imagine individuals that are put into solitary are there because of disciplinary problems once they're incarcerated. How, if you remove that tool, how then would you, quote unquote, punish those folks for those infractions while they're in prison?
Sure. Yeah. What are alternatives? Thank you, Mark, for that question. Yeah. That's Mark in St. Augustine. Shalini, what are alternatives? If prisons phase out solitary, as other states are beginning to do, we should note, what are alternatives that the criminal justice system could go to instead?
Well, states, a number of other states have tried other options. And before I get into that, I just wanted to mention that, you know, what Loretta is talking about is folks are being put into solitary for all types of things, like talking back to a correctional officer for refusing to follow an order, right? So those are the kinds of things that you wouldn't think would merit the severe sanction of disciplinary confinement or in, solitary confinement, but that's in fact what's happening in our system. And then in terms of the types of interventions to be used otherwise, if you look at other states, for example, like at Washington State or even at Colorado, those correctional systems have started to grapple with what kind of damage they're inflicting on their own prison population by resorting to solitary confinement. I've tried to start reducing the numbers and trying to figure out ways to integrate, to create units of individuals in prison so that, you know, like a number of folks who would otherwise each be in solitary confinement are instead in a joint unit where they are able to interact with each other along with other individuals. Oftentimes, I think in the Washington State example, they've sometimes incorporated them with other potentially high-risk prisoners who they consider high-risk or who are themselves subject to, you know, target from other folks in prison. So they, you know, have a unit that I think involves some folks who are sex offenders as well as folks who have would otherwise be placed in solitary confinement. And they've figured out a way by providing sufficient mental health supports, because that's really one of the primary reasons that folks end up in confinement to begin with, to have a sort of a functional environment for people and to give people some, individual and group therapy that's helping them to actually come out more rehabilitated instead of damaging them further. That's really the counterproductive sort of path that Florida is on, where we're, you know, when we put folks in solitary confinement for these extended periods, then they come out and they are not able to function anymore in the general population, and that leads to sort of more recidivism, and it's kind of a self-perpetuating cycle. Even when they get out, it's the higher rates of recidivism among those individuals.
It's 549-2937. Do you think the state should end solitary confinement in Florida's prisons? Let's go. We lost our next call. We just lost that call. But you know what, Shalini? I want to ask you as a follow-up. You filed this in federal court. So tell us a little bit about the process going forward.
So we filed it as a class action. So we're seeking to represent all 10,000 individuals who are currently or who will be placed in isolation in the Florida Department of Corrections. And so we have yet to serve it on the defendants. And so we will hopefully serve the lawsuit on them shortly and then, you know, seek class certification. So there will be a hearing before the judge to decide whether this condition of isolation is something that's generally applicable to this whole group of people and thus should be litigated as a single lawsuit.
And have you taken similar legal action against solitary confinement in other states?
Our organization has worked on solitary confinement in other states. It's been an issue in some of our litigation in Mississippi in youth correctional facilities. And it's also been a big issue in a lawsuit we have currently against the Alabama Department of Corrections, challenging health care and mental health care and general conditions in the prisons in that state. And so one of the primary findings, actually, from the federal judge in that case has been that, you know, kind of what I started off with that this solitary confinement exposes everyone to a substantial risk of harm, because you just don't know going into solitary confinement who is going to have the kind of severe mental health damages. And it's not obvious. It's not just folks who go in with mental health illnesses to begin with. It's often you know, routinely folks who you would have no idea would suffer that kind of psychological impact, who do suffer that harm once they're in solitary confinement.
Well, Laurette, tell me about how you're doing today. What are you up to now after going through this experience?
My sleep patterns, now I've been home a little over a year. My sleep patterns have not changed since solitary. I can't sleep more than 3 hours at a time. And, you know, any given day, I'm up at 1 a.m. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, I get tired again. And I take another three-hour nap, and then I'm good for the day. So the sleep pattern has not changed. I don't like being behind closed doors. Being in a small area is too much. I start getting panic attacks. I start, you know, with just panicking. It's not, and I don't know, honestly, if that's ever going to break, if it's ever going to leave. Like I said, I've been home a year, and it hasn't stopped.
I'm really sorry to hear that. I'm so sorry to hear that.
And, thank you.
And so I guess what is your message then to people that are listening to this and they're just kind of hearing about it now for the first time? What's the most important thing you would want them to know as someone who experienced solitary confinement for a minor infraction?
This type of behavior needs to cease and desist. There are other ways to handle minor infractions rather than 28 or more days, whatever they deem as your punishment in solitary confinement. There are other ways to handle this. I mean, you know, look at it this way. If your child, whether it be a toddler or a teenager, does something wrong, breaks your rule, do you take them and throw them in a closet and shut the door for 28 days? Is that punishment? Or do you sit them down and talk to them about why their choice was wrong? Do you understand what I'm saying? You just don't do this to people. You don't take people and just throw them away like they're trash. You don't do that. If you took, this is a real hard subject for me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I understand.
You just don't treat people like this. There are other ways to handle situations. You don't do it. It's wrong. It's just straight up wrong.
Let's go to Charles on the north side. Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Hello there. Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I'm calling because I have a son that's in solitary confinement. And it's actuality, it's about a 5x6, enough to pace yourself to death, I suppose. But my son was put in solitary confinement. He was threatened with his life for about a week's time, threatened to be stabbed, and he's going to be alone sooner or later, and he's going to get stabbed then, and he's got to go to the bathroom, and he's going to get stabbed, and it more or less ended up into a fight. And my son got put in solitary confinement for defending himself. Now, he does have more or less mental issues. He was diagnosed when he was younger. He's 30 years old now, but when he was younger, he was diagnosed with ADHD and also schizophrenia. So I agree with some of the people saying that, my gosh, it's going to make things worse. I don't see any good coming out of it for a man defending himself. That was my comment.
I appreciate that, Charles.
What's going on.
Yeah, thank you for that, Charles. Okay, Shalini, your final thoughts.
It's just long time that this practice comes to an end. I feel like for too long, the Department of Corrections has relied on this because it's, you know, folks in prison are kind of out of sight, out of mind. But, you know, the way that we enact punishment is a reflection of our values as a citizenry. And we have to, our government needs to be accountable to what we think is humane. And I think at this point, you know, there's consensus that solitary confinement is torture, and so it has to end.
Thank you both for being with us. Shalini Goel Agarwal, supervising attorney with the SPLC, and former inmate Laurette Phillipson. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And much more still ahead later in the hour. The roots of Southern rock from right here in Duval now making their way to a PBS series. We'll tell you all about it. But up next, our movable feast. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, it's one of the most unique and popular food trucks around. In this week's Movable Feast, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks to Lakita Spann of Mr. Potato Spread. Yeah.
Have a banana, Hannah.
Tell me about your business.
Mr. Potato Spread began as actually a delivery and catering company. We started attempting to create somewhat of a cult following by creating these over-the-top loaded potatoes, potato salads, and fries.
Oh my gosh, who doesn't love that?
Yes, you can do anything with a potato. And so that was the idea. And so we've done some really over-the-top shrimp and lobster scallops, but we also do, you know, pulled pork barbecue potatoes.
How big are your potatoes that they have these whole meals inside of them?
They're pretty large. The potatoes are all Idaho potatoes that we have brought in directly from Idaho. So they're very large potatoes. A lot of our customers joke that technically they're lunch and dinner. So it's definitely more than a meal.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So your fifth anniversary plan was to do something. And what did you just achieve?
We just opened our first restaurant. It's a pickup location. It's in out of the Regency Square Mall food court. And so ever since we began, that was the number one request, because we started out, as I mentioned earlier, as a lunch delivery company to businesses. And then in 2016, we got the food truck, but we also only went to businesses with the food truck. And so a lot of our customers would chase the truck around town or order for delivery to their jobs, right? And so the number one request was, we just want to pick up from somewhere when we get off of work, or we want to pick up and have dinner at home on a Sunday or a Saturday evening.
So you're inside the Regency Mall.
We're inside of the mall in the food court. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much for being on Movable Feast today. And I'll see you by Mr. Potato.
Looking forward. Thank you so much for having me.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
And in a moment, right here in Duval, a preview of the new PBS series, The Roots of Southern Rock. We'll be right back.
Linda Taylor was a master of deception. She lived under several identities, gaming the welfare system until her fraud sent her to prison. The complexities of her scam are so legendary that they led to a well-known, still-used stereotype, the Welfare Queen. The mythological roots of a continued political divide over social services, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Next school year, Florida will allow teachers to carry guns inside the classroom.
Most of our teachers would stand in front of a crazed gunman and take a bullet for our students. We have got to trust some of these teachers that would do that to protect our students as well and give them a fighting chance.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, where we talk about the biggest stories in the state.
From politics to education, the environment, and more. If it's news in Florida, we want to hear from you.
Let your voice be heard. Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at noon on WJCT.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Well, Jacksonville, Florida, of course, is home to the amazing genre of music we all know as Southern Rock, with beloved bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Allman Brothers, 38 Special, and Molly Hatchet, all getting their start in and around right here in Duval. Now, PBS is planning a mini-series telling this incredible musical story. Here with more, we welcome Dr. Michael Ray Fitzgerald, author of Swamp Music, and also a new study titled Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock. Dr. Fitzgerald, good morning. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And as we talk about this, and this area's fame is the birthplace of Southern Rock, give us a call. Who's your favorite Southern Rock band? What's your favorite Southern Rock song? Maybe there are even some people out there that have memories of Lynyrd Skynyrd's early days in this city and other bands. Give us a call and share your stories as we talk about Southern Rock. Okay, so First Coast Films LLC made a splash last week. They are signing a local production company, Pine Ridge Film and Television, to develop this miniseries for PBS. Pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's right. I'm real happy about it.
Yeah, so you are really someone who I think would be more happy about this than anyone, because you literally wrote the book on Southern Rock.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I'm in the process of writing it right now for University Press of Florida, called Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock. But there are several books out about Southern Rock already.
And tell us about what you've uncovered as you've been doing your writing.
Well, I'm focusing just on the groups that came out of Jacksonville. Contrary to popular opinion, Jacksonville is not exactly the birthplace of Southern Rock. It was happening in a couple of other places before it happened here. But,
like where? Daytona Beach?
Oh, Louisiana with Tony Joe White. Even California with Delaney and Bonnie. Memphis. Black Oak, Arkansas came out of Memphis. This was all even before the Allman Brothers were even in existence. So it's, you know, and furthermore, you know, genres of music don't get born anyway. They really slowly evolve before they even have a name. But I would say that Jacksonville, being not the birthplace of Southern Rock, was definitely the mother lode.
And why do you think that happened? How did all of that come together at the same time?
That's the $64,000 question here, really. A lot of it had to do with the baby boom. So there were a lot of young kids, you know, picking up guitars at that time, all over the country. But in the South, guitar playing was a respectable pastime. It was more than a pastime, really. And it was kind of a had kind of that feudal troubadour cachet to it. It was a family tradition, you know, making your own entertainment. There wasn't a lot else to do in Jacksonville at that time. Even in the early 50s, there wasn't even a television station here. I think there was one maybe in 1949, was, I think, Channel 4 in 1949. But there wasn't much to do. You made your own entertainment.
Uh-huh.
You had a lot of young kids playing guitars, making their own entertainment. You had a lot of Navy kids coming to town. And the Beatles hit and made this all very, very hip and cool. And it was just sort of a perfect storm.
Yeah. And so as PBS plans this miniseries, people that have heard these songs on the radio for years, they'll get to hear the full story of how these bands came to be and really blew up around the world.
It's pretty fascinating. I'm writing my chapter on the Allman Brothers right now, which basically evolved out of a band called The Second Coming, who were from Sarasota and moved to Jacksonville. But, you know, the question, why were they moving to Jacksonville? Because there were so many gigs here. I mean, you had bottle clubs, teen clubs, bars, youth centers, and it was just exploding with gigs for musicians.
It's an incredible history, and it's sort of strange to watch how belatedly Jacksonville is embracing this history. I mean, only recently did we see plaques go up, Florida Historic Marker plaques, at the home on the west side where the Van Zant brothers grew up, and another plaque in Riverside, where the Allman Brothers first had their legendary first jam. And so what do you think about the fact that Jacksonville has sort of failed to capitalize on this incredible musical history and really make it more of a tourist attraction and publicize it more?
I think we need to do this because it's one of the few things the city is famous for, besides, let's say, the Jacksonville Jaguars. It's one of the few things the city's famous for, but for a long time, people just didn't like Southern rock. A lot of people here didn't like it. It had a sort of redneck cachet.
It's interesting because I think over time, people who might have been musical snobs about this genre of music have really come to appreciate that it is just a fully American musical form blending sort of blues and bluegrass and country music into this fusion sort of sound, and that these were incredible musicians. They were really good at what they did.
That's all very true, but the heart of the story, I think, is the work ethic from the groups from Jacksonville, because ever since Barry Oakley started the jams, the B-ins at Willow Branch Park, you know, those guys were working six nights a week at a club called The Scene, and they would spend their day off playing for free. I mean, they were playing five hours a set, six nights a week. They were probably putting in 60 hours a week. You know, a day job would have been a vacation compared to that. And so the Allman Brothers laid down this work ethic that everybody had to follow if they wanted to compete. And certainly, without a doubt, Skinner was the hardest working band ever.
Right. And as we watch this PBS miniseries, we'll learn about their famous or their infamous Hell House, this shack that they would rehearse in Green Cove Springs mm-hmm. in the heat of summer. They would rehearse 6-7 days a week, 10-12 hours a day, and that's how they got to have such a tight sound.
That's what I'm talking about, and that's what Al Kooper saw in them, was all this preparation and rehearsal. When he got him in the studio, he hardly had to do anything. They were ready to go.
Let's go to your calls now as we talk with author and professor Michael Ray Fitzgerald about the history of Southern rock. PBS is producing a mini-series on the bands that call Jacksonville home. We don't have an air date for that yet, but you will be able to see it on WJCT television when it's ready to go. 549-2937. Share your Southern rock stories with us and your thoughts. Rebecca is in Lakewood. Hey, Rebecca, good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I was thinking about this in your comments about Jacksonville just beginning to embrace its Southern rock roots. And I've kind of had this noodling idea for a while that sort of to revitalize, everyone talks about revitalizing downtown and what to do with the Landing. And I was thinking about how Cleveland was really part of its revitalization was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I just wondered, why doesn't Jacksonville do something like that, have a Southern Rock Hall of Fame? And you can have an event every year with, you know, bands and, you know, just kind of celebrate more than just a few plaques.
Yeah. And, you know, Rebecca, I've heard that idea brought up before, and I thank you for mentioning that. A lot of people have had that thought. So thank you for that. That's Rebecca in Lakewood. why don't we have a museum dedicated to this rich musical history?
That idea has been kicked around for a very long time. And I wouldn't just limit it to Southern rockers, though, because Jacksonville has a plethora of famous musicians besides the Southern rockers. I mean, we had Ray Charles come through mm-hmm. here, Limp Bizkit, Red Jumpsuit Opera. I mean, there's mm-hmm. been more than 100 national acts come out of Jacksonville, which is phenomenal.
Black Keys. Yeah, there have been a lot.
Incredible.
So there is a unique musical tradition here that needs more focus, needs a focal point where people can learn more about this, going beyond this PBS program that we're excited to have and to show.
Well, maybe we could have a North Florida Music Hall of Fame and then just have a section of it be dedicated to Southern rock. But, there's too many others to just dedicate the whole thing to Southern rock. And especially a lot of famous African-American musicians have come out of here, jazz players. And also James Weldon Johnson came from Jacksonville, the guy who wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing.
That's right. And there is a memorial to James Weldon Johnson that's being put up in the La Villa area of downtown. That's being worked on as we speak. At the same time, I'd encourage everyone to stop by the Ritz Theater and Museum in La Villa, where you can learn all about how La Villa used to be known as the Harlem of the South, all the world-famous musicians who played here at the clubs that are no longer standing, sadly. And so
Ray Charles lived in that area. He lived right where the La Villa School of the Arts is now.
Right. And so you can learn about that at the Ritz Theater and Museum, which is great. But I think that when people talk about the need for a bigger focus on this in the city of Jacksonville, I think they're right that we could do more. And let's go now to Jim in Nassau County. Hey, Jim, good morning.
Well, that was quick. hey, how about Blackfoot? That's another local band, isn't it?
Oh, of course.
Or yeah. Parts of it are local. What I was going to say, what I brought up was Jimmy Carter had those. Had those concerts for pre-election. He had one in Orlando, Atlanta, and Jacksonville, and he had one in the Gator Bowl. Mm-hmm. Marshall Tucker, Skinner didn't make it. But there was a huge paper cup fight. I don't know if anybody remembers that.
Really?
however many people in there were throwing paper cups. And it was just...
could have been worse.
The whole thing was fun.
But, how funny,
Southern rock tradition, especially with the Van Zants and... lots of them, Outlaws in Tampa. And anyway,
yeah.
That's it. Love
thanks,
Southern
Jim.
Rock, love the area. All right, thanks.
That's a great story. People have there are still so many people I run into all over this community whenever we do this topic, and they'll tell me, I saw them play in the early 70s at this little dive bar when they were just getting started, that kind of thing.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
I was in the Forest Inn the night when Ronnie Van Zant announced the group was changing its name to Lynyrd Skynyrd.
What year was that?
Oh, I guess 69 or 70.
Wow. So you really are a longtime fan, aren't you?
I saw Duane Allman sitting in with the Second Coming at the Woodstock Youth Center in 69.
Well, if you love stories like this, don't go away, because we're going to continue talking about the roots of Southern rock as a PBS miniseries is planned. It's going to be shot by a local production company, too. More music and more talk about this in just a moment. Don't go away.
You mean I'm an old guy?
After the rise of $1,000 smartphones, can a $300 model still compete? We put that question to the test.
And we're curious to find out whether people who aren't phone geeks, will you be able to tell the difference?
I'm Molly Wood, testing the smartphone economy, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Next school year, Florida will allow teachers to carry guns inside the classroom.
Most of our teachers would stand in front of a crazed gunman and take a bullet for our students. We have got to trust some of these teachers that would do that to protect our students as well and give them a fighting chance.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, helping your kids survive and thrive in their college years. We talk with psychologist B. Janet Hibbs and psychiatrist Anthony Rostain about the challenges of parenting one of the most stressed out generations of teens. Hibbs helped her son navigate his way through severe depression and anxiety. Their book is called The Stressed Years of Their Lives. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Linda Taylor was a master of deception. She lived under several identities, gaming the welfare system until her fraud sent her to prison. The complexities of her scam are so legendary that they led to a well-known, still-used stereotype, the Welfare Queen. The mythological roots of a continued political divide over social services, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. As we continue our discussion now with Dr. Michael Ray Fitzgerald, author and professor, about the roots of Southern rock and the new PBS miniseries that will be shot right here in Northeast Florida. We're taking your calls, too, and emails as we talk about Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Allman Brothers, and more. Okay, so you told your Lynyrd Skynyrd story, or one of many you probably have. I'll tell you mine. About 5 or 6 years ago, I had to interview Johnny Van Zandt by phone because they were doing a special concert in town and they wanted to publicize it. So they gave me a phone number to call because the band was on the road. The publicist gave me a phone number to call and they told me to call a certain hotel and to ask for Kid Stone. So I called the number and the voice answered, and I said, "Hi, is Kid Stone there, please?" And the voice on the other end said, "Hey, this is Johnny." And I said, "Oh, is this Johnny Van Zandt?" He said, yeah, sweetheart. And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I was told to ask for Kid Stone." And he said, "Sweetheart, that's my hotel room fake name, you know, like Kidney Stone."
Oh.
And so it's funny because famous people never check into hotels under their own name. So I can tell everyone that's the name that Johnny Van Zandt uses when he travels.
Cool. Johnny is a really nice guy. I met him in 79. I knew his parents. I knew his whole family. I didn't ever meet Ronnie, but I knew Donnie because I had auditioned for a group called Sweet Rooster, for which Donnie was the lead singer. So I go back with the family to about the mid to late 70s.
So when you first started watching them perform in these little places, did you ever think that they'd become what they became?
Not a chance. Not one iota. I didn't like them, frankly.
Why not?
Because I was a big Second Coming fan, and in those days you were in one camp or the other.
Okay. And explain the two camps for people that aren't familiar.
Okay, the Second Coming was Dickie Betts's band, which sort of evolved into the Allman Brothers. And those guys were like musicians and musicians.
I see.
And the 1%, which became Lynyrd Skynyrd, were kind of like the underdogs. And they were sort of the working class group of musicians.
Yeah, more blue collar.
And you fell into one camp or the other. So I was a Second Coming fan.
So when PBS airs this, and by the way, they have international rights, it'll air all over the world. What are the most important things that you hope people learn about Jacksonville and this musical tradition?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. But I think the thing I've learned is that it takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication. And that was one thing you really got a hand to Barry Oakley and to Ronnie Van Zandt. I mean, they drove their band members almost like slave drivers, and if you couldn't keep up, you fell on alongside the road. So, I was for those guys. It was all about work, work, work. It's unbelievable, and it's if you think about it, that's the American dream. You work hard, pays off for you big. Well, it worked for them.
It sure did. And I can't wait to see the series. As soon as we have an air date here on WJCT television, we'll let everybody know. In the meantime, pick up Swamp Music by Dr. Michael Ray Fitzgerald. And he's also writing another book out this fall, looking at the roots of Southern rock. So good to hear your stories and your insights on this. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Brady Corum is our director today. And if you have feedback, we always like it. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Here's a little Allman Brothers to start your work week off. Speaking of hard work, we'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.